thank you very much. Thank you, Sue. My name is Arbutus O'Neill, and it is for the grace of God that I belong to the Al-Anon family group. I am powerless over people, places, and things. And because of the program, I can make this admission today without feeling guilty. My life continues to be unmanageable when I fail to practice principles that were given to us by a bunch of ex-drunks who found sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to believe that the families of the early members of AA were convinced by the miracle of sobriety that this program would work for everyone. And it was out of this conviction that the Al-Anon family groups grew to reach all over the world and have shown astounding results. We subscribe to the concept that alcoholism is a family illness. And then we get so carried away telling people how sick we got that we forget to say we have a program for family recovery. Ours is a fellowship that shares. But please, let us try to share our recovery, not our sickness. And I am just delighted with this conference. I have never attended a conference sponsored by the hospital and institutional committees. And I think you might be interested to know how the Al-Anon institutional committee started. You can't say that it was a coincidence. One of my friends in Australia says that a coincidence is something happens when God wants to remain anonymous. And that's kind of how this institutional committee started years and years and years ago. Ann Bingham, as all of you probably know, was a co-founder of Al-Anon, a very shy, retiring lady. Got a letter from a warden in Joliet Prison in Illinois. He inquired if there was any way that the families of the inmates of that penitentiary could be helped to learn that alcoholism was an illness. He knew, of course, that the people that attended the AA groups in that prison were getting help. But he was concerned with the families. And no one had ever thought about attempting to do this. But Ann got the idea. And she contacted the warden. And eventually what grew out of that contact is what you all are projecting at this point in time. And I think it is absolutely marvelous. When I was the first panel delegate, they appointed me as a member of the institutional committee. And I said, heaven's sakes, there's no point in this because we're not doing anything in institutions in Texas. And they said, that's why you need to be on the committee. And I went back to Texas. My husband had never been in a treatment center. He'd never been put in jail because of his drinking. He'd been arrested a few times for being drunk in car. I don't know if y'all do that in California or not. But when Bill got too drunk to drive, he'd just pull over in a dark bar ditch and sleep it off. And a few times he got arrested for that. But that was the extent of my experience with anything that slightly favored an illegality or a hospitalization. But I went back to Texas and I interviewed the administrators of the 7 state hospitals in Texas. They weren't even sending the families a piece of literature. And they had a program of sorts on the alcoholic ward in the state hospitals under the auspices of AA counselors, but they had done nothing to give the families any information. So I got the bright idea that we'd create a research team and start an outreach program for the families. It started off very simply. When the patient was admitted in the state hospital, they gave me a spot in the Wichita Falls Space Hospital that had the greatest majority of revolving door drunks. They gave me an office in the psychology building, and I went over to the admissions office. And some of those people came in there voluntarily, and they only had to stay 10 days. So we had to work pretty quickly. And I'm a patient lady. I said to them, I want the nearest of kin of each one of those patients on my desk before the ink gets dry. And Jay, they just about accomplished that. I talked to the legislature. I talked to everybody that would listen to me and some of the people that wouldn't listen to me. But we did develop an outreach program that's still in place today. We don't have as many federal penitentiaries in the state of Texas as you have in California, and this is understandable because your population far exceeds that of Texas. I've not had the experience of working in the penal institutions as much I would have liked to, but when I was on the Board of Trustees, we put that program into place. Some of the literature from which the ladies read today was developed by those committees. The pamphlet Homeward Bound was developed by the Institutional Committee. The guidelines that you use in your fact-finding kit came out of that institution. And I wish Anne could see what you are accomplishing today. I know that she would, as I do, applaud you and salute you. And I'm grateful to be here today. I talked to Bill last night. He sounded good. Keith is in Texas, about 9 miles from my house. And I'm out here. But Keith took the time yesterday to call Bill. And when he learned that Bill did not have a driver to go out to the 4-H encampment, he came in and visited with Bill. And I can't wait to give him a big hug for that. I'm very grateful to be here. And I wish so much that all of you would get to know my Bill. I'm called a long-timer in the Al-Anon family groups, and that doesn't seem very important until you get to be a long-timer. And it isn't hard to do. It doesn't take any great effort. You just keep coming to meetings and try to stay alive, and then you'll be a long-timer. It's been my privilege and great joy to talk to a lot of people in a lot of places. And you all have been reminding me all weekend of, I met you at a woman's thing, I met you here, I met you there. And I come back to California every opportunity I get so I can get an ego boost. And I really got some great ego boosts this weekend. I once thought that alcoholism was a product of my generation, but this isn't true. Alcoholism is as old as time. Alcoholism is a progressive, insidious, fatal illness that prompts the unthinking to make jokes about drunks, but it can leave a family homeless and penniless. Alcoholism is a public cancer that can turn a man or a woman against themselves. Alcoholism is a blight on the history of mankind. The Bible warns against it. Shakespeare diagnosed it. Tennessee Williams built a prize-winning play around it. But no one, as far as I've been able to learn, seemed to be able to do anything about alcoholism until the advent of AA. Priests and ministers wanted to find they were baffled at their inability to cope with this insidious habit, this dreadful malady, if you please. So they preached to alcoholics, prayed over them, had them to sign pledges, and when these things failed, they damned your soul to hell. Men of science, before the advent of AA, wanted to find a cure for alcoholism. They wanted to find a pill or a vaccine that would stop compulsive drinking, and failing to do this, they said to the medical students, don't waste your time on these people. They're hopeless. Preachment failed, and there was no cure. So there was only one other thing they knew to do with alcoholics. You must be punished. So we locked you up in jail. The more you drank, the longer we kept you in jail. And the longer we kept you in jail, the drunker you got when you were released. It was kind of a vicious cycle. We tried to change the body chemistry of sick people with punishment. And society allowed this to happen. Nay, we insisted on it to our everlasting shame. But there was one group of people who never gave up on the alcoholic. These were the families of alcoholics, the people who loved you. We took jobs to feed the children that you were too sick to be responsible for. We doctored your hangovers. Some of us bought your liquor. We picked up your hot checks. We bailed you out of jails. We pled with judges. We said, John's a good man when he's sober. And to complete this ridiculous paradox, every time you got drunk, we gave you hell. And society was puzzled by the behavior of the families of alcoholics. How about that? They could understand the alcoholic. When you wrecked your cars and wore lampshades on your head at parties and did the ridiculous things, they could understand that because you had been drinking. But they couldn't understand us. They could not understand why we continued to love and care for the alcoholic. There were some people, of course, that thought we were endowed with some special quality that made us better than other people. They were the ones that gave us the nice shiny halos to wear. And we accepted these halos quite willingly. I put mine on every morning when I put on my lipstick. And my halo had a name. It was called self-righteousness. What was yours called? Yeah, what was yours called? And then there were other people, of course, that thought we were just plain fools to live under such circumstances. And my mother came in this group. Mother used to say, God looks after fools and drunks, and that takes care of our abuse and bill. And Mother was right. And God did look after us when we didn't have sense enough to look after ourselves. And then a little farther down the line, the professionals got interested in the families of alcoholics. They were the ones who originated the labels that they put on us. Aggravating influences, we were called. A disturbing factor, how you like that? And then they got real corny and they called it Suffering Susie. Wavering Winifred. Faltering Francis, and the names went on and on and on. I was privileged back in about 1975, I think it was, to participate in the summer school on alcohol studies out at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. Marty Mann was there and some of the dignitaries, the professionals stayed downtown at the Hotel Utah, and the rest of us slummed it out at the dormitories, and I learned why the students at the University of Utah get their degrees so quickly. Their dormitories are not air-conditioned. But we had a choice bunch of professionals at particular times. Some of them came from the state of Oregon. There was a few from California. But the prize one of all was a character from one of the leading hospitals in New York City. He was head of the psychiatric department. Now, he was what those people in Texas call a dude. He wore a beautifully ruffled fronted shirt. He had a nice Van Dyke beard, beautifully trimmed. And the professionals lectured to us. And then they gave us a question and answer session for 8 minutes. I never did understand the 8 minutes. They could have stretched it and called it 10 minutes, I think, pretty easily, but they didn't. And this particular doctor, who shall remain nameless, told a story about one of his patients. This gentleman had been in his clinic for a full year for the treatment of alcoholism. And when the man completed his full year of sobriety, his wife, and he was released, his wife was so delighted with his sobriety that she went out and bought him a quart of scotch. And the audience in Utah did just like you did. They laughed a little louder than you did. And I didn't think the story was funny. And when we got to the question and answer session, and we were permitted to question the good doctor, I raised my hand and he acknowledged me. And I said, "Dr. So-and-so, did you at any time while this gentleman was in treatment explain to his wife that he was suffering from an incurable, progressive, fatal illness and that resumption of drinking could bring about his death or insanity?" And he said, "No, I don't recall that I did." And I said, "If I were you, sir, I wouldn't tell that story again. It makes you sound like a damn fool." I had a little problem with professionals. I worked on the perimeter of mental health for about 9 years, and I found out that those doctors have the letters MD after their name, not G-O-D. And they're just people. Some of them are good and some of them are bad and some of them are indifferent. But we must always remember what Bill Wilson admonished us, how Bill Wilson admonished us. He said, "Let's be friendly with our friends in the professions." And don't misunderstand me. I have tremendous respect for our friends in the professions. But these people who were so puzzled about this whole situation, of course, they had studies. I noticed just recently an article in one of the magazines that was that had been written by Margaret Bailey. I didn't know she was still around anymore. But she was the one who did the most, did more of the studies than other people about the families of alcoholics. I can remember one time when I was at New York for a conference meeting and I went over to the NCA office and she was interviewing people to find out what kind of a woman marries an alcoholic. And Marty said, "Why don't you go over and help Margaret with her survey?" And I went over there and she didn't give me a form to fill out and let me answer the question. She asked me and wrote down my answers and she kept shaking her head. She said, "You're not like other people. You're not like other people." And I was real glad I wasn't like her. But her conclusion, and the government paid her a large amount of money for that survey, but her conclusion was not valid because she found out that women do not marry alcoholics. Women marry men they love, and sometimes they develop alcoholism. But no one in their right mind goes out and marries an alcoholic, for heaven's sake. AA members are a pretty safe bet, but let those others alone. But these professionals were completely and utterly confused with something that showed up in their surveys. Now, I believe that I'm pretty confident that at this point in time, when I'm looking out in a room full of people like I'm looking at right now, that those of you who are seated in this room knows what an alcoholic is. Don't you think that's a pretty reasonable conclusion? You know what an alcoholic is. They're sorry, low down, no account, drunken bum, who never works, never draws sober breath, and abuse their families. That's what an alcoholic is. Everybody knows that. But in their survey, they discovered that some very brilliant, talented people were alcoholic, and this didn't fit their little mold at all. They could not put a round peg in a square hole. They just could not do it. And so I did some research, and I learned that Alexander the Great was an alcoholic. How about that? He'd conquered the whole known civilized world when he was 33 years old, and he wept because there were no more worlds to conquer. But he could not conquer his desire to drink, and he died prematurely in an alcoholic convulsion. Stephen Foster was an alcoholic. He gave the world its most beautiful folk music, but he was a compulsive drinker. It seemed to come on him like a sickness, his wife once said, and so it does. They found Stephen Foster sick unto death on the New York Bowery, and when he was dead, they found in his pockets 38 cents, one penny for each year of a misspent life, and the lyrics to another song. Stephen Foster loved his wife, his genie with the light brown hair, but the love of his wife couldn't stop him from drinking, and he died drunk. Robert Louis Stevenson was an alcoholic. He could weave the magic of children's stories, and he all but destroyed himself with the magic that he found in a bottle. It could have been a quart of gin or a fifth of bourbon. And he describes the personality change of the alcoholic in the story, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And I watched this personality change right in my living room, just like a lot of you did. You saw the bottle change the man you love into a babbling idiot, into a degenerate animal, into Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, history said very little about the families of these men and others like them, but I believe that I know the loneliness and the fear that Jeannie knew when she waited for her restless, talented husband to come home from one of his sprees. I believe I do. And I believe that I know the homesickness when Fanny Stevenson left her home here in California to go to a South Sea island with her husband in hopes that he might regain his health. Robert Louis Stevenson had a dual problem. He also had tuberculosis. And I believe that I know the joy that they knew when he did regain his health. And I believe that I know the serenity to some degree that they both knew when he found sobriety. And my friends in Al-Anon, you know, these Al-Anon people are nitpickers. And they're always saying, why do you do this and why do you do that? Why didn't you tell them this and why didn't you tell them that? And they say to me, why do you feel it's necessary every time you get a shot at one of those microphones to give us a history lesson? Why do you do that? And of course, I have a good reason. I can't tell jokes. I always forget the punchline. No, that isn't the reason at all. In this, and in all of these surveys that these people were doing, and the callousness, that's the best word I can think of, the callous attitude that people took toward alcoholics and their families changed as these surveys and these researches went on. And it's now possible, as you and these committees know, to get a man or a woman in a hospital for treatment with a simple diagnosis of alcoholism. This was not always true. When my Bill's drinking became critical, it was not possible to get him in a hospital, not unless the doctor was willing to make a false diagnosis and say something else was wrong. You couldn't do it. Priests and ministers now feel that alcoholics are God's children too, and they send them to treatment centers to get help, and they send their families to us so they can get well too. And if all of you are perfectly aware, I'm sure, of the tremendous work that the National Council on Alcoholism and other educational facilities have done to educate the public that alcoholism is in truth an illness, and that alcoholics are sick people, and that they need and deserve treatment. And these things took a long time to have any effect on the attitudes of people who were in contact with alcoholics or their families. It's almost impossible anymore to pick up a magazine or a newspaper and fail to find an article on alcoholism. I was amazed one month last year to find an article on alcoholism and the Atlantic Monthly, for heaven's sakes. And you know, that's a snooty magazine. They don't just print everything that's submitted to them. I was quite amazed to find it. It seems to me that in these days, it's the end thing to have an alcoholic in your family. Now, if you don't have one, I suggest that you go out and borrow one. Don't marry them. just bar you want. They're the handiest things you can get. They're as handy as a pocket on a shirt. Everything that goes wrong, you can blame it on the alcohol. I'd have been happy to loan you a few years back. I was overstocked. No, the thing that I'm trying to point out to you is that with all of the effort that's being made, including the effort of our hospital and institutional committees, in spite of all the effort that's being made and all the money that's being spent and all of the experts that we've accumulated, these people are not getting the job done. Had you noticed that? They're just not getting the job done, these people in the professions. They're not getting the job done because they do not know all there is to know about alcoholism. But when I look at a group of people like we have here today, I'm looking at a room full of experts. You're the people who know about alcoholism. You know about alcoholism because you've lived with it. You know the symptoms. You know the progression. You know about alcoholic convulsions. Some of you have lived through the terrors of DTs, not many of you, but some of you. And these are the things that the professionals don't understand and we can't explain. But we are the people, you and I are the people who can solve this problem that has harassed generations and generations of mankind for years, endless years. And this is a job for you to do. Because you're so uniquely qualified to do it because you've lived with this problem. And you've survived it. And you have the coping mechanism. You have the program. You have the tools of the program. And so this is a responsibility that belongs to you and to me. And I learned this a long time ago. You see, when I came into this outfit, it was before we had an outfit. We didn't have a program to live by. We didn't have a purpose to live for. All we really had in those early days was the growing awareness of a great need for help and the very dubious permission of some people who were very new in AA to come to their meeting places while they had a meeting, and that's what we did. We met in wide hallways and dirty little kitchens around this country, anywhere we could put a few chairs. And we sat together and we talked. Now you know very well what we talked about. It was kind of a morbid competition to determine which one of us lived with the sorriest man. And I wasn't comfortable in those meetings because I did not live with a sorry man. I lived with a fine young man who drank too much. And I wasn't very comfortable in those meetings, but I get a little defensive about them when the Al-Anons of today talk about, you know, those people that had gossip sessions and they helped the alcoholic too much and on and on and on. And I remind them, I said, don't be too critical. If we had not been there then, you would not be here now. And that's true. We didn't have any literature. Dear Lord of mercy, we didn't have enough pamphlets to paper the walls of this room. We didn't have 12 hardback books, each contradicting the other. We didn't have any literature at all, not a single piece. But the dear people who put the life-changing program of Alcoholics Anonymous together were visionaries. They knew that in time, the families would become aware of their need for help, and they made provisions for us. Al-Anon is a kissing cousin to invention because they were both born of necessity. And these dear people knew that in time, we would become aware of this necessity. So when they wrote the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, they included in that book two chapters just for us. Now one of these chapters, as you well know, is entitled Two Wives. That is not intended to be a put-down for you fine men who are members of the Al-Anon family groups. Not at all. When that book was written, there were no women sober in AA, and so they addressed that chapter, Two Wives. The early groups in Canada called their groups wives groups. The other chapter, of course, is entitled To the Family Afterwards. And we took a paragraph out of this chapter back in the part of the country where I grew up in Al-Anon, and we used it for a preamble to open our meetings. And this is what the paragraph says. The past is the principal asset of the families of alcoholics, and frequently it is almost the only one. This painful past can be of infinite value to families still struggling with their problem. We feel that each family which has been relieved owes something to those who have not, and when the occasion requires, each member of it should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others how we were given help is the only thing that makes our life worthwhile. Cling to the thought that in God's hands, your dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death or misery for them. Now, that's pretty heavy stuff. And with all of the literature that we've published, and I do believe that we have an unlimited printing budget, of all the literature that we've published through the years, I have not found one single piece of literature that more clearly points out to me what my responsibility is to the families of alcoholics. And I haven't found a piece of literature that more clearly points out to me how I can show my gratitude for the sobriety in my home and for the good things that that sobriety has brought to us. Not one piece. Now, of course, there's a rumor going around in this third generation of Al-Anon that under no circumstances, on any occasion, should you ever take a book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in an Al-Anon meeting. Yay, yay, yay. Ha, ha, ha. But I'm blessed among women. I was privileged to grow up at a time and be exposed to the spiritual giants of this fellowship. I was privileged to visit and talk with and be counseled by people like the late Icky Sheridan and Al Badger and Horace Fort and Burton Davies and, yes, Chuck Chamberlain, and many of you, many of those dear people who are not here anymore. When I came to Texas some 50 years ago, I was totally and utterly defeated and did not know how to quit. And I was absolutely flabbergasted at what was happening to my Bill. My Bill is a gentleman, a brilliant person, handsome, the goodest guy you ever saw. But when he drank, he was absolutely and totally irresponsible. You couldn't believe a thing that he said. He broke promises upon promises, one after another. And I was 1,700 miles and more from my family. And they didn't want me around anymore because I wouldn't leave Bill. And I was absolutely frustrated to death. And I went to these spiritual giants, and I said to them, I don't understand Bill. Bill loves me and the children, but we can't depend on him. I never know if he's coming home or not. I don't know what to do. And they handed me a book, and they said, read the first 164 pages of this book, Arbutus, and it will explain the nature of the illness that Bill has. Dear Lord, that's what I wanted. And they went on to say, and it will teach you the philosophy that you need for your recovery. And I was home free. Because if you print it in a book, I believe it. And I read that book and I wore it out. I found Bill, as Elsa used to say, on every page. But I took that philosophy to mean exactly what he said, that if I would do these things, then I could get well. And I can find no better reason than to admonish the people that I sponsor to study the first 164 pages of that very same book as if their life depended on it, because it does. Now, please, when you quote me, listen carefully to what I say and quote me properly. I did not say I want every Al-Anon family group member in the world to read the first 164 pages of the big book. I did not. I simply said that I require the people that I sponsor to study that book or get themselves another sponsor. I don't care if the rest of you stay sick the rest of your life. I'm not your sponsor. In Al-Anon, we share our experience, strength, and hope, and that's what I try to do when y'all ask me to come out here to your dues, and I'll try to do that. I attended my first open AA meeting in Amarillo, Texas in 1948, and I didn't want to go to that meeting. Bill took 6 years to make his first year of sobriety. And I didn't have very much confidence in my young husband's sobriety. And I certainly could not see a constructive reason to associate myself with a group of people who, by their own admission, had ruined everything they'd tried to do in their whole life. I could not see it. You stood behind podiums like this and you admitted that you had ruined your health, you'd lost your business, you'd lost your family, some of you had been in jail. And I didn't want to be associated with that kind of people. And I certainly didn't want to belong to a group of you, for Pete's sake. I was having enough trouble with one of you. I didn't need a group. And the only reason I went to that meeting is because I put myself under an obligation to a lovely lady who was married to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you haven't picked up on the accent yet, it is not a southern accent. I'm a hillbilly. There's a difference in a southern lady and a hillbilly, and I'll explain that some afternoon when you have plenty of time to listen. But hillbillies don't like to be obliged, and I was under obligation to this lady, and I went to the meeting only. That was the only reason I went to the meeting. It was an open meeting, as I said. There was about 150 people there, and I drink a lot of coffee, you may have noticed. And I'm sure I'd made numerous trips to the coffee bar. And after we were seated in the meeting, a very beautiful woman that I later learned was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous leaned across Marguerite and whispered to me. And what she said was, "How long has it been since you had a drink, honey?" And I wasn't embarrassed by her question. I'm not a teetotaler. Keith wants me to join AA, but I'm not qualified because one of the requirements is that you have a desire to stop drinking, and I don't want to quit drinking. But I wasn't embarrassed by her question, but Marguerite was. And so she said to the lady, "Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism." I grew up in a house with two men, both of whom was my father. My father was a two-fisted construction man. He worked hard, and he played hard, and he drank hard. Dad was a gray-eyed Irishman who taught me to sing Irish folk songs. He taught me to love poetry. He had the patience to teach me to work my geometry problems with his framing square. But on Saturday night, my dad turned into a devil. My father's alcoholism destroyed both of my parents. My father's alcoholism turned my beautiful mother into an old, ugly, bitter woman who hated him. She hated him as long as she lived. She hated him long after he was dead and in his grave. And the last years of her life, which she spent in total darkness, she hated anybody that had ever loved John Martin, and that included me. Dad was a hallucinating drunk. He was totally and utterly insane when he drank liquor. He saw creeping, crawling things, and he hurt my mother. He hurt her emotionally, and he hurt her physically. Mother never could quite understand when her jaw was broken that Dad had simply meant to kill a centipede that was crawling in her hair. She couldn't understand that. And I'm quite sure I could not understand that either. And Dad was a gentleman from Virginia, and he loved to make things for Mother. In those long winter nights back in the hills of the Carolinas when it's too cold for construction people to work outdoors, Dad would spend those long winter months building something for my mother. Sometimes it would be a table, sometimes it would be a china closet, whatever. And Dad loved wood. He loved wood. I've watched him caress a piece of wood many times, much the same as a lady caresses a piece of velvet or a piece of satin. And he would say of the wood as he caressed it, "This wood has a beautiful fault." And I didn't know what he was talking about until I got into this program. He would select the wood very carefully. He would put it together with great precision, as only a craftsman can do. He would sand it and polish it and truly make of it a thing of beauty. And then he would smash it in a drunken fury. My father's alcoholism destroyed both my parents. And Dad was one of those people who never made this program. He used to come to Texas and he'd go to meetings with Bill and me. And when we'd come home from the meetings, he'd ask us a question. Dad would say to Bill, "How do you get the want to, Bill? How do you get the want to?" Dad never found the want to, and he couldn't stay sober. And for years and years on end, when I gained the courage in this fellowship to ask the God of my understanding for special favors, I used to close every day of my life with one special prayer. "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I cannot tell you why that's such a terror to those of us who love alcoholics. I cannot tell you that. I can only tell you that it is. My father died in 1965. He had throat cancer. He did not die drunk. And when my brother Mike called to tell me that Dad was terminally ill, he said to me, "We're going to have to pray extra hard for Dad Arbutus. He's not going to make it." And I said, "No, no." Now, you know very well that I did not want that selfish stuff to destroy that beautiful baritone voice. You know I didn't. You know I didn't want that selfish stuff to make it impossible for my dad to even have a drink of water. You know I didn't, but I prayed, "God, don't let my dad die drunk." Now, I do not tell you these things about my dad or about my mother that you may weep for them. No, no. My dad's all right. My dad is all right. He does not have to drink anymore. And my mother doesn't hate him any longer. I tell you these things that you may know that I have always loved an alcoholic. And because I love alcoholics, I want to restore their families. Because alcoholics love their families more than anything else on earth. Of this I'm convinced. Even when they tear us down over and over and over again, they love their families most. I believe this with all my heart. And I would like you to know that when I met that tall Texan that is the father of our children, I was not concerned with Bill's drinking. Father Martin says you can't identify an alcoholic except by the one that you know, and Bill did not drink like Dad. Bill was not a hallucinating, insane drunk. Bill was the life of the party drunk. He crashed debutante's party and talked the sponsors to put your little foot. I lost him one time in Philadelphia in an Italian wedding. So you better watch this. I'd catch glimpses of him through the weekend. He was gone for 3 days just having a ball in this Italian wedding. When he finally came back there, Remy had a new silk shirt on. I guess he got pretty smelly. But he just had a ball. He was not a hallucinating, insane drunk. And I wasn't concerned about it. I drank Wickville. We worked for a company that sent us all over the United States, and we got drunk everywhere we went. Dear God, we've been awful drunk in Los Angeles. San Francisco, Chicago, St. Louis, San Antonio, everywhere we went, we got drunk. It was very important in my generation for people to have fun. I heard an AA lady say she had so much fun it liked to kill her. And that's just about what happened to Bill and me. But then in 1940, two things happened that should have made Bill and me grow up. We became parents. And I brought Peggy along with me on this trip, and then I have a nephew down in Los Angeles who's a psychologist with the juvenile department, and he's one of those take-charge people. And so after Sue said she would get Peggy a banquet ticket and let her sit up here and look pretty for you, Jack called and said, I've made some reservations and blah, 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 and I'll pick Peggy up at the airport and bring her back Sunday, so you won't get to meet Peggy. But she's a little doll. She really is. And she was born in 1940, and Bill and I became parents. And, oh, la, I quit drinking with Bill. You know, I had a pretty little baby girl, and my lifestyle changed. We had our second child the next year, and Bill wasn't there when Nancy was born. She came on Wednesday, but she didn't get to meet her dad till Sunday. And when Bill came to the hospital with the usual paraphernalia that you men bring to us when we have your babies, he caused a great deal of confusion in the hospital because he wanted to teach the Catholic nun who was in charge of the maternity ward the Texas Stomp. And the dear sister didn't want to dance. And when he left the hospital with the help of two big burly orderlies, he sat down on the streetcar track in full view of my window, forced the motorman to stop so he could tell him about our new baby girl. You see, Bill was still having fun with his drinking. Our only son came the next year, and this time the trip to the delivery room was a little different. Something went wrong, and they needed Bill. Now, had I been able to talk to them, I could have told them that they'd find Bill in the bar when they couldn't find him. He wasn't to be found. He got tired in the waiting room, I guess, and went out to get a drink. And I could have told them, you know, look in the bar, but I didn't know which one. Now, my friends in AA tell me there is no loneliness in the world as great as that of the alcoholic who has run out of time. And I believe they believe this. But I also believe that I know about loneliness. The loneliness of an alcoholic's wife when she goes to a delivery room with the full knowledge that a compulsion to drink is depriving her of her husband's devotion. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. This lonely feeling, this desperate, hopeless, lonely feeling, when your child cries for her dad at night, and you can't find her daddy. This, I believe, is loneliness. The crawling fingers of loneliness that you feel when you wait by the hospital bed of an injured child that cries for a daddy, and you can't find her daddy. The lonely task of keeping the spirit of Christmas alive for small children whose father has forgotten what day it is. This, I believe, is loneliness. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. Our little boy, our third son, our third child, was born with a birth defect. I couldn't talk about this for a long time because of the overwhelming feeling of guilt that a recitation of this incident made me feel, because I manipulated that pregnancy. We had two little girls, and I knew that Bill wanted a little boy. I guess all of you men want a son. And I gave Bill a son who couldn't walk. And that created an obsession in me that all but destroyed our entire family. Because I spent the first several months of that little boy's life going from one crippled children's hospital to another, consulting one doctor after another. I was determined to find a doctor that would make my son walk. I didn't have anything to pray to, so I didn't pray for him to walk, but I was determined that I would find a doctor that would get the job done. Our fourth child was another little girl, was born in 1943. She's a year and 18 days older than her big brother. Now, if this sounds confusing to you, I'll explain it. My brothers and members of Bill's family had gone into the military. My sisters and my mother had gone into distance plants during the Second War, and I stayed home and kept up production. And thankfully and gratefully, that third little daughter of ours, our Teresa, was one of those beautiful, healthy child that thrived on loving neglect, and that was fortunate because that's what she got. Because I was involved with physical therapists and doctors and crazy stuff, trying to find a way to make my boy walk. And I want you to know that when the illness progressed and Bill started losing jobs over the country, one of these jobs took us down to Knoxville, Tennessee. Just about the time that they brought that atomic energy plant down there. And I get the picture. Here's a sleepy little southern town. Everybody's going about their business and enjoying their mint juleps at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And thousands of people pour into that city to go to work in that atomic energy plant. We had leased a furnished house in Knoxville, Tennessee at that time that rented for $50 a month. And this is the part of the story that I don't like to tell, but Bill insists that I do it because he says it's real good for you. How about them drunks? We were evicted from that house in Knoxville, Tennessee that rented for $50 a month for non-payment of rent. And Bill O'Neill had a good job. He worked for Holland Furnace Company. He had a good salary. And he was not at all reluctant to take a little extra money under the counter if he needed a furnace real bad. It was not at all unusual for him to make $700 or $800 a week, and that was a lot of money in the 40s. And we were evicted from a rent house that rented for $50 a month. And I was expecting Teresa at that time. And because of this influx of population, I could not find a place in Knoxville to live. And I had to go up into Kentucky, a little coal mining town up there, in order to find a garage apartment. And I was expecting my fourth child any minute. I found a garage apartment in Middleton, Kentucky, and I checked in with the hospital to make arrangements for the delivery of our baby. To learn to my great dismay that I was not eligible for treatment in that hospital because it was for the exclusive use of the coal miners who lived in that area. And about the time that I got that beautiful information, they carried Bill home again. Now, they'd carried him home before, of course, but this time his leg was broken. He'd had an argument with his boss, and Bill O'Neill never won a fight in his life. He was forevermore getting in fights in bars, and he must have felt 10 foot tall because he'd pick on the biggest bruiser in the bar and just get the big J-boos beat out of him. But they carried him home, and they did agree to put a cast on Bill's leg in the emergency room. And then I was faced with the proposition of taking Bill and the babies back to Cincinnati, Ohio, where my mother lived. And Mother didn't know I was pregnant. My mother was 12 years older than my husband, and God, she hated him. She hated him with a purple passion. After he got an AA, she thought she hatched him. Well, we got to Cincinnati, and I got a taxi cab to take us out to Mother's neighborhood. I don't know who was most relieved when we got to Cincinnati, me or that bus driver. But we went out to Mother's neighborhood. She lived in one of those exclusive apartment complexes, you know, the kind that doesn't allow children. One of those Southern Mansion type entrances, and there was no elevator. So I went up to Mother's floor, I think it was the second floor, knocked on her door, and now get the picture. Peggy is 3 years old, Nancy is two, Luther is one, and he can't walk, and I'm expecting another baby any minute. My stomach looked like a watermelon, you know, and I'm balancing Luther on my big belly, and I knock on the door of my mother's apartment, and she liked to drop dead. She liked to drop dead in her tracks. And I said, would you please go downstairs and help Bill, Mother? And she said, what is the matter with him? Is he drunk? And I said, no, Mary, his leg's broken. So she went down and hauled Bill upstairs and set us down on the living room couch, you know, for one of those talks. And she said, of all of my children, I guess you undoubtedly are the most brilliant child I have, but it takes a real genius to get in a mess like this. And Mother was able to get me a hospital bed in a ward in a Salvation Army hospital because one of her friends from Virginia was head of that hospital. And our fourth baby, another little girl, was born in a Salvation Army hospital in the charity ward. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. This was not the last of the eviction notices that I was to see. And then I became familiar with another agency. And I'm quite sure that my friends in Texas don't quite appreciate this part of my story. I don't believe they'll ever understand what it means to a hillbilly to ask for charity. I don't think they'll ever understand that. I was to become familiar with welfare agencies. And each time that I saw one of these eviction notices and when I made application for food for my children, I saw the look of pity and disgust on the faces of the people that I had to make these applications to. I saw the pity and disgust on the social worker's face when she wrote on my application blank in bold black letters as if I couldn't read, husband is a drunkard. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And I want you to know that when I came to the state of Texas 50 years ago, now it is, that I had never heard the term alcoholism in reference to my young husband's drinking. Not one single time had I ever heard the term. But I watched this boy lose everything that he had that he wanted to keep. My Bill lost his left eye as a result of drinking, and he could not stop drinking. My Bill lost his left arm as a result of drinking, and he could not stop drinking. He lost his self-respect. He lost the confidence of the people that he worked for. He lost the affection of his own family members. And finally, he lost his own self-respect. And I never shall forget the day that Bill looked up at me so hungover that he wanted to die, and he said to me, why don't you take the children and leave, honey? I'm no damn good. Mrs. O'Neill is not an alcoholic, but she knows about alcoholism. And when I came to Texas, as I said, I had never heard this term, the term alcoholism in reference to Bill's drinking. But then something happened after we came out to Texas 50 years ago. We met some people. These people call themselves members of AA, or of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never shall forget the first member of Alcoholics Anonymous that ever talked to me. He came to my house in the middle of the afternoon. I'd called a minister who seemed to know about facilities to help alcoholics, even those that many years ago. And this man came to my house, and he described to me what I referred to then as this rehabilitation program for alcoholics. I didn't know anything else to call it. After about 2.5 hours, I asked the gentleman a question. I said, what do you have in this rehabilitation program of yours for the wives and children of alcoholics? And nobody had ever asked him that question, I'm sure, because he couldn't answer it. He said to me, we don't have anything for the wives and children, Mrs. O'Neill. You do not have a problem. Shoo. I thought the man was wrong. I still think he was wrong. I couldn't wear sleeves on my arms at that time because of a rash that was caused by nerves, the doctor said. I was so nervous I couldn't stand in my own shoes. And this dear man said, you do not have a problem. And I believe it was that self-same cold November afternoon when I stood in the living room of a mean little rent house in Brownwood, Texas, where we wound up, that I made up my mind that someday, somehow, I would find a way to help the families of alcoholics. And then, by the grace of God, that opportunity came to me because we met some more people. Now, this was a weird bunch of non-alcoholic people who found it vitally necessary to practice the principles of the AA recovery program in order to preserve their stability and to restore their sanity. And I knew these people. When I came to these people, I was totally and utterly destitute in all areas of my life. I had no faith in God. I had no confidence in my husband's sobriety, and I certainly did not trust people. People do not deal very kindly with families of alcoholics. And God knew why I couldn't trust people. I'm sure that there were times when I tried to pray, and I believe that God heard me. I believe that God listens very carefully to the prayers of the alcoholic and to the prayers of the beginners, because he knows that we don't have the words that prayers are made of, and that we don't have the courage to speak aloud. So he listens, I believe, very carefully. And he heard me. He heard me when all I could say was, oh, God. He heard me. And he knew why I couldn't trust people. I couldn't even trust myself. I was not responsible for things that I said, and I was not responsible for the things that I did. And I did not come here to get Bill sober. I came here to try to find the disintegrated pieces of a personality that once was me. And I came here because my children were afraid of me. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not a child abuser. My children were afraid of me. They were afraid of my disapproval. If they spilled a glass of milk on a white tablecloth, I punished them unmercifully. If they brought home a grade card and they'd made a C, I wouldn't accept it. Failure had been bred out of me. Hillbillies don't fail. We may get an equalizer, but we don't fail. Failure had been bred out of me, and I would not accept it in my children. And my Bill was ashamed of me. And I didn't want my children to be afraid of me, and I did not want my Bill to be ashamed of me. And back in the mid-40s, they were writing a lot of articles in the ladies' magazines about something they called group therapy in the field of mental health. And that's what I thought the family groups, which predated Al-Anon, I thought that's what they were. And so I made my way to one of those family group meetings. And those dear people put my nose down in those 12 steps, and I had a distinct feeling that they wouldn't let me come up for air if I didn't take those blasted steps. And I took them for the worst possible motive in the world. I was going to take those steps and get an A+ up in the corner of my paper and slap it down in front of that gray-eyed Texas sponsor of mine, and I was going to say I took these booming steps and they didn't work. And they did. I'd like to be able to tell you that overnight I became a wise and wonderful woman, but that, of course, is not true. But my life did change, and that's what I wanted. That's what I was looking for. First thing I could notice, of course, when my life changed was the fact that my children were no longer afraid of me. They got so brave they assessed me, and that took a lot of courage. Then a little while later, I was aware of the fact that, once again, Bill was proud of me. And that's very important to those of us who love alcoholics. Elsa used to talk about this a lot, this sick need for approval. You remember her talking about that? this sick need for approval is a very real thing in those of us that love alcoholics. And I think you can understand it because I've already told you what an alcoholic is. Would you not agree that an alcoholic is just about as low down on the social totem pole as you could get? Would you not agree to that? I would. And then you rejected us. You know, I never will forget that first home group that Bill belonged to. They had a pool table out on the screened-in back porch, and I found out that men gossip. You know, I didn't know they were supposed to, and certainly not AA members. And I went out to the clubhouse one day before everybody was wearing slacks and sneakers. I need some literature to make a 12-step call, and I went in, wasn't trying to be quiet, I just didn't make any noise. And I went to the literature cabinet to get the literature, and these AAs are out there talking about somebody, and I clicked up my ears. And in a few seconds, I realized they were talking about me. And what they said was, that boy don't have a chance. There's no way on God's earth he can ever stay sober, not in love with the girl he's married to. So I closed the door very quietly and went home and took my inventory. No, you rejected us, and that is a real, real sick need for approval, and we don't need very much of it. You'll just have you once in a while say you did a good job, you look nice, you smell good, that's about all it takes, isn't it? Well, I knew these people, I was drawn to them. Some of them were born with an understanding heart. And the rest of those people seem to have developed this understanding because they had lived with a serious illness and sometimes with tragedy. And I didn't have to have a psychologist to explain to me why these people could help me. They could help me live one day at a time. And they could give me the courage to face life one day at a time. And they had a hodgepodge of names, as I've told you before. But finally, they got a name that all of us agreed we would use, and it's called Al-Anon Family Groups. Now, I think you've gathered by now that I have a tremendous respect and affection for AA. It saved my husband's life, and later it was to save the lives of two of our children. But I have a greater respect for the Al-Anon Family Groups, because at that particular time in their life, it was the force that put our family back together again so we could recover together. And I think you've noticed that there's a little bit of difference in Al-Anon family group members and AA members. There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. Did you ever notice that? I don't know what happens to the quitters, bless their heart, but they don't make it in Al-Anon. There's no quitters in Al-Anon. We never quit hoping. We never quit hoping that that boy we married will come home again. We know he's lost down the bottom of that bottle, and we keep hoping that someday he'll come home again. Hope burns low at times, but we never quit hoping. And we never quit helping the alcoholic. Methods get a little drastic sometimes, but we'll help you to death. But most of all, we don't quit loving the alcoholic. There's no quitters in the Al-Anon family groups. And I took the principles of this program, Bill and I did, and we reared these four children. And I used to stand behind microphones like this around the country and say, I'll put those 4 of ours up with any 4 in the world. And I'm here to tell you that I still would. When our youngest daughter was graduated from the university, magna cum laude, I puffed up a little bit and I said, that ain't bad for a drunk's kid. That little boy who wasn't supposed to walk weighed into the United States Navy at 189 pounds. He served 3 years in the Navy because they had to discharge him a day before he was 21 because he wasn't quite 18 when he went in. He came home, and with his dad's help, he started a little business. Had 25 people, men older than he was, working for him, and I said, that ain't bad for a drunk's kid. And as I say, we took the principles of this program, and we reared those children. And they did the things they wanted to do, and they did well in their endeavors. And we were happy. I don't think we were complacent. We were just plain happy. We went all over the country. As you know, Bill has one of the largest and oldest tape libraries in the world, except for this particular area right in here where Joe Kirk was working. Bill taped, made conventions, tapes all over the United States and Canada. We met thousands and thousands of people, and you told us you loved us, and it was wonderful. We were just plain happy. And then our kids got mixed up with some other people's kids, and all hell broke loose. We married off all four of them, and we got three of them back, but I had made a condition. I said, you can come home unless you multiply. So we didn't have to take them right back in the house with us. And at that particular point in my life, I was totally and utterly obsessed with an urgency that I had no way to understand or to explain. And I've been guilty of standing in places like this and say, if there has been anything written about the disease of alcoholism that I have not read, it has been published within the last 24 hours, and that was almost the truth. The girls used to worry their head off and scold me regularly about the fact that I never slowed down. I had a nervous energy that you wouldn't believe, and I couldn't quit going. And it took me long to understand why I was filled with this urgency, this need to know, to understand. And finally, I began to understand why that was necessary for me. Again, it was for the wrong motive. But I intended to create an environment in my home that would prevent alcoholism. It had destroyed two generations of my family, and I was not going to have it threaten the lives of my children, and I was going to see that it did not. I forgot one small thing called body chemistry, and you know there is no environment that prevents alcoholism, but I did not know that. And I started getting telephone calls from various and sundry parts of Texas. I got a telephone call from the Austin area, and the AA people down there who loved me said, you can go to sleep now, Arbutus. We followed Luther home, and he turned in his own driveway. This little boy who wasn't supposed to walk had developed alcoholism. But I'd been in the program a large number of years, and I let him alone, and I thought it would kill me. Then I started getting telephone calls from the other side of Texas, up at Wichita Falls, 10 miles from the Oklahoma border. They called to say to me that Nancy had slipped in the ladies' room at the country club and gashed her eye very close to the eyeball. The floor was wet, you understand. And I let her alone. I'd been in the program a large number of years. And if I thought it was tough to let Luther hit bottom, it was a piece of cake compared to what I had to go through when Nancy got into difficulty, because I had heard the people, the AA ladies, tell me how vulnerable they were and how exploited they were. And because of a very messy divorce, Nancy fled the country and went to live in Mexico for 5 years, and I don't speak Spanish. And you can't get a telephone in Mexico just because you've got the money to pay the bill. They put you on a list. Finally, I found an AA couple down there that could relay messages to her. And I envisioned, you know, I have a tremendous imagination. I put her on Skid Row. I envisioned her in a Mexican jail, and I like to lost my mind. One of the characters up in Oklahoma, when the kids got into difficulty with their drinking, he said, now we're going to see what kind of program Arbutus has. And it wasn't very solid at that point in time, but I let her alone. I let them both alone. And I'd like to report to you this afternoon that Nancy O'Neill celebrated 13 years of sobriety last September, and Luther got his 13th year, Valentine's Day of this year. I can't abide negative thinking, and I do not entertain it. It comes uninvited, and we're under no obligation to entertain it. And it hasn't been easy this year. When Luther had the heart attack, it's been 2 years now, and the doctors didn't think that he would survive the ambulance ride home. But he's lived 2 years with 19% of heart action. He's training sheepdogs. They have sheep in Texas, too. And his attitude is absolutely marvelous. He's with his dad this weekend. And he is totally and utterly without fear of dying. Sean is doing much better. This was his little 10-year-old boy. And Sean is coming up 12 years old the first day of next month. And he's no longer afraid to go to school for fear his dad will die while he's in school. They're doing all right because they have a program. And when Bill O'Neill started hemorrhaging at the top of Texas Roundup last October, you know, he looked there for several months. He has a pacemaker now. He's an ulcerated stomach, pernicious amnesia, not amnesia, pernicious anemia, I'll get it right. And all of the health problems that he has, he went down to 117 pounds. He developed that condition that anorexic people develop that causes them to die. And it's been rough. It's been rough. But we're all right because we've got a program. People come from out of state to check on Bill and they expect to see me flat on the floor. But I don't have to be there because I will not entertain negative thinking. What is going to happen in our lives is God's will, not my will, and I don't have to concern myself with it. When all of these things happened to Bill, I intended to call committees around the country and say, would you please ask someone else to come to your convention for your Al-Anon speaker? And Bill said no, and Luther backed him up. They said, you need to get away. So I make about one of these trips every month, and Bill shot me down, of course. He said, you're nicer to live with when you take a break. And I do something that I didn't used to do. I call home when I get to the hotel, and I notify the desk that if I get a telephone call, that they're to find me wherever I am, but they're not to put a little note in my box. And a few things like that. I don't call those fears. I call those, what was the gentleman say this morning? Protecting your assets. But the O'Neills are all right because we have a program. And I can say to you, I believe without fear of contradiction, that the principles of this program will solve any living problem that you will ever have. And I think that perhaps I might be some kind of an example, good or bad, because we've lived through most of the living problems that most families can have, and we've survived it because of the principles of this program. And I'll tell you the same thing that I always tell you. The principles of this program carries a message that the whole world needs to know. And you are the only people that are so uniquely qualified to carry this message. Just you people. If you fail to carry this message, there are drunken men and women right here in this beautiful valley that will die in drunkenness at this deep posture, never knowing they're alcoholic if you fail to carry this message. If you fail to carry this message, there's men and women in this beautiful valley and in Brownwood, Texas, and every other city or village that I know who will not have the courage to face life one more day with an alcoholic, and they'll break up their homes if you fail to carry this message. And there's kids in this town. Dear God. This is Saturday, and Saturday night was the worst night of all, remember? There's kids that never heard of Alateen. And these kids will grow up with deformed personalities if you fail to carry this message. If you fail to carry this message, may God have mercy on those people. And may God have mercy on us.